Failure is not an option.
What difference at this point does it make?
Nobody said it was going to be fun.
This is Real Talk, a fearless, poignant, and intrepid show where truth speaks louder than words. This is Real Talk with your host, Audrey Russo.
The shame, not of this world, so we live on the run. We keep our eyes set, on what is to come.
It happened before. It will happen again. It's just a question of when.
Time's a luxury we don't have.
Hi, this is Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark. For insightful dialogue and discussion, tune in to Audrey Russo at Real Talk Radio.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, this is Audrey Russo, and you're listening to Real Talk. President Trump's Afghan speech surprised some of his most ardent supporters. Is the swamp getting a hold of this outsider? And a national security advisor, McMaster, was a concern when he was first being considered for his now-held position. Are we now seeing what we feared about this man infecting the administration? Well, we're going to discuss this and more with my next guest. For my new listeners, Diana West is the author of several best-selling books, including The Death of the Grown-Up, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization, and American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. She's a former nationally syndicated conservative American columnist whose blog is one of Newsmax's 50 best conservative blogs, which tackles controversial subjects such as the impact of Islam and the failures of counterinsurgency. Diana has contributed essays and features to numerous periodicals, including The Wall Street Journal, The Weekly Standard, and The Washington Post. She has also been a columnist for The Washington Times, Scripps Howard News Service, and United Media. And she can be read at The Daily Caller. Diana is also a popular analyst and contributor on both radio and television. It's my great pleasure to give a Real Talk welcome back to Diana West. Welcome back, Diana.
Thank you, Audrey. Great to be with you.
It's always great to have you with us. And, we're going to jump right in here. Although President Trump's Afghan speech was a good one, there were many that were disappointed in his decision to surge rather than pull out of Afghanistan. What are your thoughts on the speech?
Yes, I am one of the many who is not only disappointed, I feel deeply betrayed by President Trump, who essentially caught our attention in March of 2016 with that fantastic America First foreign policy address. And one of the things he specifically discussed was reversing course, not going with the people with the great resumes but failed wars, and really addressing American core interests. I don't believe there are any American core interests in Afghanistan, end of story. And what he is doing is he has signed up with some of the main culprits in our 16-year failure. And that would be Generals Nicholson, Votel, Dunford, and Mattis, and others. But those are, of course, the biggies. And this is very disturbing because what they imagine some indeterminate number of Americans can do now that 150,000 troops couldn't do over that 16-year period, I do not know. But it is a very worrisome thing because this continued engagement to stand up a Sharia state where there's no freedom of speech is going on while we are not addressing the threats to our country, including the loss of freedom of speech in our own country, including the incursion of jihadis across the Western world through immigration, migration, refugee resettlement, and the rest of it. So re-engaging in Afghanistan could not be a worse move, and I just bemoan this decision.
Well,
I think it reflects the rise of leaders such as NSC Director General McMaster, who's part of this whole, I didn't mention his name, but he is, of course, as a lieutenant in the metaphorical sense to General Petraeus, is, of course, also associated with the same failed military strategy of counterinsurgency. And I think we can see, just, and I'll turn it over to you, but I think we can see his influence in the president's speech, where I believe he mentioned terrorism 16 times and never used the word Islamic, which used to be one of his big hallmarks, that no one could call it, quote, radical Islamic terrorism, but now he isn't even calling it that. So I think we're looking at that because this is the kind of policy that McMaster is directly associated with, and we might want to tease that out a little.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I want to touch on that because I was going to say that a lot of people, the looming question after the speech was, what happened to America First? And, of course, you nailed it right there when you mentioned the fact that during that speech he never said Islamic terrorism, where on his the rally that he had in Arizona, he did say that. So you can see, obviously, that McMaster had nothing to do with that.
Right. No, it's true. Well, you know, he chose McMaster to lead his National Security Council, someone who makes no bones about his own apologetics for Islam, which include his belief that there's nothing Islamic about terrorism. In other words, the absolutely canonical doctrine of jihad is something that he believes is un-Islamic. I mean, it's the most remarkable kind of apologetic. Either he believes it and he is ignorant, or he is being deceptive, which is, of course, worse, but either way, the effect is the same. And we are going to go back into Afghanistan with the same blindness to the law and doctrine and culture of Islam. So we will be looking at more what they called, I really bristle at the term, but green-on-blue murder, Afghan army murder of American, and if there are any allies with us, troops, which we saw scores of. We will be seeing all manner of continued corruption, money wasted, untrainable training. My contention is we have very different ideas about or hallmarks of winning. The Taliban win every day we spend blood and treasure in Afghanistan. We have a very different problem. Our problem is Sharia creep throughout the Western world. That is not won in Afghanistan. I think we need a new line of battle, very, very clearly. Our line of battle is not in Afghanistan. But however, so long as we're engaged there, so long as we're wasting munitions on remote hilltops 6,000 miles away from downtown New York, we are not addressing the threat of jihad, and we are not addressing the menace, the greater menace of Sharia, of the entrenchment of Islamic law and culture onto non-Muslims, which turns us all into what are known as dhimmi, who essentially live a very depressed, repressed, suppressed life of Islamic apologetics, so you don't set them off. I mean, this is essentially where we have been going, certainly since 9/11, and nobody really wants to call a halt to it, and we thought Donald Trump did. He was very brave. He talked about Sharia even in a very good speech. I believe it was about this time last year, and certainly talked about Islamic terrorism and certainly talked about immigration and halting Islamic immigration or some form of giving it a pause, and now we're back to we're back to the old Bush-Obama policies where Islam is peace, is not the problem, has nothing to do with the ideology that is driving the jihad. And that is so dangerous, and it's it was a terrible moment, really, for certainly a diehard Trump supporter, as I had been.
Mm-hmm. I understand. With McMaster, I'm still puzzled by the president's support for him, because he certainly does not reflect what the president said on the campaign trail. He also doesn't reflect what he said in Arizona at his rally. So, who do you think in the administration is influencing him or lying to him about McMaster?
I don't know. I don't know that anyone really is. It does seem to go back to the character and personality and worldview of Donald Trump. If we know what McMaster says, and McMaster presumably says it to the president and presumably influences his speech, which omitted all mention of Islam or even Islamic as an adjective, we know he is understanding of that. And when he gets outside of Washington and he reverts to his former self, is he just simply trying to keep his support up? Is it something that calculated? I don't know. I don't pretend to understand it, but it's very disturbing. And I think at the bottom line becomes, well, what is the policy? It's very well to go out and say things and get cheers from your adoring fans. It's quite another to agree to give the generals a blank check. I mean, this is supposed to be a civilian government-led government, and here we have what is essentially shaping up to be kind of an American junta that makes all the determinations regarding military force, even after 16 years of trying to do the same thing. And now they say, well, they'll let them do what they need to do to complete the mission. And you think, well, what is the mission?
Yeah.
There is no mission in Afghanistan. If jihadis stay in Afghanistan, they do not threaten San Bernardino or New York City or Munich. And that's a fact. So you start thinking, well, how do we get to there? And that's where you go back to the notion of immigration law, of Sharia being a measure of immigration, of refugee resettlement, a whole new, really, all these programs should be halted and completely studied and understood, because, of course, we still have a democratic process here. And so when you import a Sharia demographic, you will democratically become a Sharia state. I don't think that is what Donald Trump supporters who won 31 states for him want. So, this is where we go. And plus, think how cheap that is. If you're just simply redesigning, retooling your points of entry and, what kind of immigration policy and what kind of refugee resettlement policy, which he actually has a lot of control over. Some of it, of course, has to go through Congress, probably wouldn't, but he does have a lot of control over certain things. He can stop, obviously, the Dreamer Act that President Obama unconstitutionally mandated without Congress and simply made his executive order. He can revamp a lot of the refugee resettlement rules similar fashion without Congress. He's not doing any of those things, which certainly are cheaper and better. And when you think about the burden on our military since 9/11 and all of these heartbreakingly multiple deployments we have seen between Iraq and Afghanistan, the wear and tear, the attrition of our hardware, just simply the nuts and bolts of the military, the numbers of replenishment, the amount of replenishment that is required to bring us back up to any kind of fighting stance, it's a shock to think about redeploying in any form to Afghanistan, and certainly after our experience there. And again, you go back to the notion, why American blood and treasure to stand up a Sharia state in a culture that sanctions child rape, child marriage, the enslavement virtually of women, and the rest of it, and cruelty to animals, if we want to reach out to our friends on the far left. This is the kind of thing that is part and parcel with becoming allies of an Islamic state, and once we further embark on that, we will have plenty of Afghan refugees coming here for the foreseeable future. I mean, this becomes a real two-way street in that regard, and I think it's also important for your listeners, Audrey, to understand that we have already spent more money in our dollars, consistent with the 1940s, that we did on the Marshall Plan in Europe to reconstruct Europe. Our reconstruction bill in Afghanistan is already higher than it was to rebuild Europe after World War II.
Wow.
That's a fact.
Wow. Something that he said that reveals in his speech, in the Afghan speech, something he revealed in his perspective, I find disturbing is, and I've wondered about before, because he believes, which is kind of something you'd see on the left, where there's no belief that there's anybody truly, there are no truly bad people. In other words, there's a way to make some kind of agreement with someone, because in his speech he mentioned the Taliban and maybe a possibility of them being involved in the government, and you know, where there would be some kind of agreement. I'm going, are you serious? Do you even realize? Do you even listen to what you're saying? And then again, yeah. it disturbs me, because it's a naivete about that, the fact that there are some people in this world that are evil, and they're never going to be anything but evil, you know?
Right. Or according to their lights, quite virtuous. I mean, according to the Islamic way of life,
yes,
they're
that's
doing
virtuous.
Exactly.
Yes, right.
What they, yeah. I mean, there is a logic to this. Well, you know, many people watching the period of our involvement in Afghanistan before considered Hamid Karzai to be a Taliban. I mean, there were points at which he was so angry and outraged by various American activities and his behavior and his rhetoric were truly over the top on several occasions that I recall. So, I mean, essentially, a problem exists because the Taliban is not foreign. I mean, there may be some foreign elements to it, but these are natives. These are Afghan natives for the most part. And, you know, what is Taliban? We think of it as a team or something where everybody's wearing a secret decoder ring and a jersey or something. I mean, these are people, various groups, and it's quite tribal and all the rest of it. So, I mean, the problem was that the effort that the previous war fighters and brass and theoreticians were trying to do was to win the people, the will of the people, over to our side. We thought we could, quote, nation build even as we secured territory simultaneously, which has never worked that I can find. But we thought that they would see how nice we were, how self-sacrificing we were. We had General Petraeus actually ordering or issuing a directive, I should say, to men walking on those IED-laced roads to take off their ballistic glasses so the locals could see their faces and thereby see how sweet they really were. I mean,
what?
This sounds insane.
Oh my gosh.
There is a directive. Take off your ballistic glasses. Get to know the people. And I have this longtime correspondent, a very good friend of mine, who had two sons in the Marines, one in Iraq and one in Afghanistan, and we corresponded all those years. And she pointed this out to me because she, as a mother, was very keenly aware that it is the ballistic glasses that protect the eye and the brain from exploding bombs with nails and other kinds of metal that these bombs were packed with that destroy an eye or destroy a brain. And she was appalled that the commander had so little regard for troop safety in order to put this sort of utopian vision of kumbaya to work on the battlefield, not just an academic exercise, and thereby putting at risk so many men. I mean, we have thousands of young men who are maimed and also psychologically tortured forever, as well as thousands of men who are dead. So this has great cost, and the disregard for that human cost in a commander-in-chief and his generals is appalling to me. Because for me, especially after so many years of doing this, the idea of asking the ultimate of your military and support personnel over Afghanistan seems unconscionable. This is not an American core interest. It's not like the border. It's not like trying to keep people out or trying to kill us or take down our airplanes. It's Afghanistan. It's thousands of miles away. And the point is, there is no mission that can be defined, and therefore there is no mission that can be won. And if at the back of their head, because it sounds like from what you mentioned President Trump was talking about and some comments I've seen from Secretary Tillerson, it's almost like they think they'll bring the Taliban to the table.
Right.
Everything will be wonderful.
Right.
And it's it's madness. I mean, that's just, it's, first of all, it's not worth it. Second of all, it's just not going to happen the way they hope it will. And the cost is not worth whatever we would get. So this was a bad thing.
Yeah. No, I agree. I'm still disturbed with the fact that, again, this, I won't even say it's naivete here, that it's ignorance, again, on the ideology of Islam. And that, to me, is, that is exactly what is causing the problems.
What is driving this. You're exactly right. That's a very good point. And that's what we suffered with from day one after, September 12, 2001, when George Bush began to explain to us, as he would for the next many years, Islam is a religion of peace.
Right, right.
This is the same policy, and this was not something that candidate or private citizen Trump accepted. So what happened? I don't know. I don't know who does. Maybe Steve Bannon knows. I don't know.
Well, funny, and that's the last thing I'd like to bring up here is that, of course, the Steve Bannon made his departure from the White House. The only people cheering, of course, were the enemies of freedom, the deep state. Now he's resumed his position at Breitbart and promises to fight for Trump's agenda. Is his departure good or bad for the agenda?
Well, I don't know. It certainly doesn't seem good for the White House, the possibility of the White House returning to the what I thought was the Trump agenda. It certainly will give Steve Bannon and Breitbart a great pulpit, and yet we already had that. We did that. That happened last year, and it worked. And we got someone in office in the White House. So, I mean, it's sort of like the point of the pulpit is to move the mechanism of power, to draw a movement together, to get people to the ballot box, and we did. And so going back and starting again and re-energize, you know, more power to them, but you kind of wonder, what's it all about? Is there another candidate out there who will pick up this mantle and have national appeal? I suppose that's possible. But, you know, given the real crucial demographic facts that the more our country changes through this mass immigration, the less chance there is of a nationalist candidate ever achieving national office again. So was this the moment? Unfortunately, I do tend to think so, but I've been feeling pretty pessimistic lately. I'm willing to change my opinion, but I don't really know what it's all about at this point. It's very difficult to move these levers. My fear is that if Trump does continue to betray his base, they won't come out next time.
Oh, no, they won't.
I think there's always that.
Yeah.
So
I'm pretty sure they won't.
We'll see.
Yeah, because these are critical issues when it comes to immigration. All of these issues that he was put in office for, if he continues to be tainted by the deep state instead of draining the swamp, as he was, you know, he was,
yes,
that's how he was put in office for these specific
right.
things, but he doesn't do this,
yes.
He won't be reelected.
He won't be reelected. No, he won't be. Audrey, I don't know if he's going to finish his term, frankly. Given the mood of the Congress, he has no friends in Congress, whether he does the right thing or the wrong thing, and it's a very dangerous time. I feel a lot of ground shaking beneath us as we speak. But in terms of whether there will even be a demographic for this agenda to achieve a national victory again, that's kind of at the back of my mind. Certainly some states will be able to function. But, you know, again, we look at a divided country. So it's a very, it's a very disturbing time. And you just keep wondering, what's up with you, Donald? What are you doing? I mean, I would love to have a little chat with him to find out, to see, you know, what is this psychological profile I don't get? So that's kind of, you know, it's a rough moment for people who really thought we were going to be seeing some real back-to-basics changes that put America first, that put our foreign policy in the hands of people concerned about Americans first, not the globe, and not utopian Marxist policymaking. So we're not seeing that. We are seeing him enveloped, and why, I don't know, because he is the man who hired everyone. So it's his it's his deal, but he leaves a lot of people very, very perplexed and disturbed.
And
like me.
you're funny. And worried, because we don't know what direction. Yeah, we don't know what direction everything seems to be going in. But there was a lot of disappointment from that speech about a surge rather than a departure. And, you know, with all due respect, of course, excuse me, to those who have, you know, lost their lives, we still don't want to put more in the way of you know, in harm's way. And I don't mean to belittle anyone in, you know, any of the troops. It's just that when you're tying their hands, especially by not giving them the truth about the ideology that of the people in the land where you are, you've already disabled them.
Right. Right, no, that's true, and it's worse than that, because when you enforce Islamic sensitivity on your troops, which, you know, I can cite chapter and verse on various directives about handling the Quran as a piece of artwork, never saying anything about these practices that go against the grain of Americans, whether it's cruelty to animals or to children or to women. I mean, we had that horrible case of the tea boy, the bocce boy, the little male prostitute of an Afghan, you know, of an Afghan officer who ended up killing some of our finest, and the young man who's, I'm so sorry, his name escapes me, Buckley, the young soldier who's the Marine, I believe, who was killed, wrote to his father, told his father in a phone call, I believe, how frightened he was of this situation that indeed killed him. And, you know, that's a very complex and horrifying story, but that's the kind of ally we are being told to work with. And it just goes on and on. And I just wonder, in terms of the danger to our troops from within the wire, these so-called green on blue murders, which we had a real scores of them for a period, it clearly seemed to me to be a kind of enforced policy for a period of time, and then it seemed to sort of subside. This will come back. I cannot believe it won't come back, because it is how the Taliban win. And it's heart-wrenching and horrifying when you see your own side forcing our people to put their lives at risk, even inside their own wire, for the sake of this completely untenable alliance that now we have just sort of re-upped. So, very bad, no lessons learned, and using the same people who refused to learn them all along to draft the policy and enforce it. You know, Mattis, Votel, Dunford, McMaster, all of them, they're all there. Nicholson is one of my personal non-favorites, and I've written about him quite a bit before. These are the men who are now leading this, and they're the men who really should be answering to Congress, at the very least, as to how they could possibly get everything so wrong, beginning with the facts about Islam.
Well, it has to start there, because that's the ideology of the enemy, and that's the ideology of those who are in that culture that actually support the enemy.
Right.
And so if you're giving them, you're putting them out there blindly, and then they're going to, you know, and they are now in danger. Their lives are in danger. The politicians' lives are not in danger. It's our soldiers.
No.
Who are, you know, I mean,
right.
So this is, I think it's disgraceful. And I agree with you. Why do you choose the generals that failed? Well, there are many other, you know, retired generals. I know one in particular, a friend of mine, General Paul Vallely. There were many that you could have put in a position that know what the truth is.
No, that's exactly true. And Admiral Lyons. And,
yeah, absolutely.
There's a wonderful Major Fred Galvin who's statement is actually at my website, which I commend to all who served in Afghanistan and really knows all of these generals quite well after what he's gone through in particular ways. There are people who understand, and they're not part of the Trump administration. And again, that becomes another question. Why? Why didn't you bring in people who support your agenda as a candidate into your power center? They're not there. And now with Steve Bannon having left, I don't know that war fighting is his specialty, but his other specialty certainly he shines on. Now he is not there. And certainly his own very strong feelings of America First would guide him in a lot of very helpful ways, certainly to help the president think these things through. And he's now gone as chief strategist. So, you know, and certainly all the other people that General McMaster fired of late that caused all of the headlines and great push by many conservatives against General McMaster, which so far have failed. So again, I can only conclude that this is the White House Trump wants, or somehow he is a captive of this White House that he doesn't want, but that seems quite far-fetched. So yeah. I don't really know where it stands, but it certainly isn't what we expected or what we were very specifically led to believe and excited by. I mean, people who supported Trump were very excited to see a reversal of globalism, a reversal of America being the policeman all over the world except at home. Very excited by a wall. Where's our wall? No wall. He can talk about it to a crowd in Arizona and get cheers, but cheers don't make a wall.
No, they don't.
So that's where we are.
Yeah, absolutely. Diana, where can the listeners follow and support your excellent work and purchase your books, including American Betrayal?
Yes, well, that is all at my website, dianawest.net. So anything I publish, I will also post there, and all my books and links to Amazon and so on are there as well.
Excellent. And as of course, I will, as always, have those links in my after show, which is now on the live show page. Just go to AudreyRusso.com, click on the honor button, and right under the show description, you'll find the links that Diana shared with us. Thanks so much again, Diana, for always sharing your brilliant assessments with us. We look forward to your return to the show. Until then, may God bless you, your work, and may God save America. Bye for now.
Thank you, Audrey.
Thank you.